Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming. I'm delighted that you were here this afternoon. Ambassador, please welcome you to CSIS for what's going to be a very interesting session and presentation. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS, and I'm very delighted to welcome back Randall Tobias. Now, I think we've seen you in three or four iterations through Washington here at CSIS. We first got to meet Ambassador Tobias when he was the coordinator for AIDS and HIV and just did this enormously valuable work, and we were very grateful for that and saw that leadership. And since that time, he has continued to serve in government. Of course, right now is the administrator at AID. He is taking on what I think is probably the most important mission we have as a country right now, which is to try to make sense out of and integrate our inspirational powers as a nation and bring them and harness them to the work that America needs right now. And this requires the sort of very deep engineering that fortunately a businessman of his talent and background can bring to this job. Ambassador Tobias, as many of you know, had a very distinguished career at AT&T and then went on to Eli Lilly, and of course he's just been so successful. And you ask yourself, why will a guy who's had this kind of success go into government, you know, where it's undistinguished by a lot of progress? But I think he's going to bring that. He's going to bring that to AID. He did that to the AIDS program, and we were grateful for that. And also bring together this very important initiative that President Bush launched with the Millennium Challenge Corporation. And how does that coordinate with AID? There are a lot of very important issues that need to be engineered, and we're all looking for this kind of creative leadership right now. Ambassador, we welcome you back here, and we're delighted you're here. Let me just say for everybody, we're going to do Q's and A's, but we've got little cards we've handed out, and we're going to filter out all the goofy questions that I would ask, you know, but we're going to get quality questions. Please fill out the cards, hand them. We'll have staff that'll be walking around, and you can hand them out to them, and we'll get them up, and Rick Barton is going to be taking care of that. So without further delay, I introduce to you the Ambassador Randall Tobias, Administrator of USAID. Thank you.
John, thank you very much, and thank you for hosting this event this afternoon, and thank you to all of you for your interest and for coming. The topic I want to talk about today is not mine. It is ours. And I say it is ours because we are all in this together. And when I say we, what do I mean by we? I mean those of us in this room, the governments of host nations who allow us the privilege of working with them and learning from them, our foreign service officers, our brave, committed NGO partners, our soldiers, the Congress, fellow donors, the individuals who commit themselves to analyzing and dissecting poverty, conflict, and economic growth to ensure that our practices do indeed keep progressing. And when I say we are in this together, what do I mean by this? I mean poverty, uncertainty, instability, waste, war, global warming, fear, setbacks, progress, lives saved, innovation, possibility, and potential. And when I say we are in this together, what do I mean by together? I mean that we need to have one united front to combat poverty. One united front to undermine the forces that create poverty, and one united front to break the cycles that sustain poverty. What I really mean is that if we collectively really want to be successful, and I know that we do, then we are in this together. And the time is ripe for a new deal for poverty reduction. We are seeing unprecedented attention being given to foreign assistance in poverty right now. TV and movie stars are joining forces with academics, NGOs, and the government to raise awareness about poverty issues. Corporate philanthropy dedicated to poverty alleviation is at an all-time high. College campuses across the United States are uniting to address humanitarian crises. It is very likely, indeed, as I look around this room, I can see specific faces of those of you in this audience today who have played a key role in raising awareness of the vital importance of foreign assistance. Some of you have left the comfort of your homes and families on many occasions and for extended periods because you believe so deeply that we as a nation that has been so blessed with wealth and order and peace should be doing everything in our power to help others live better than they are living now. Others of you in this room believe in foreign assistance because perhaps you have seen firsthand on the front lines in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan the undeniable positive contribution foreign assistance makes to national security. You have seen the impact of training and capacity building on the ability of a nation to take care of its people and to create a stable economic and social environment. And you know that foreign assistance reduces the likelihood of future military action. On Capitol Hill, it is rare today for a member of Congress, whether a freshman or a senior, to ask, what is the U.S. Agency for International Development? Instead, more and more members are realizing the profound and complex interconnectivity of our world and are correspondingly funding foreign assistance at unprecedented levels. Nothing illustrates this better than the recently passed continuing resolution, which prioritized HIV/AIDS, malaria, and Darfur in a politically challenging fiscal environment. And we have made great progress. I am not sure that enough people appreciate that our official development assistance for the United States government has nearly tripled over the past 5 years, from approximately $10 billion in 2000 to $28.5 billion in 2005, the last year for which we have complete government-wide data. And yet, after years of effort and billions of dollars of assistance, we still see some countries in the same position they were in 40 years ago, or in some cases, worse. Since my time as the Global AIDS Coordinator, and more so since I took this job as the first United States Director of Foreign Assistance, I have spent a lot of time in the field consulting with USAID mission directors, ambassadors, and our implementing partners about why this is so. In fact, over the past few months, I have met face-to-face with 120 United States ambassadors and with 65 USAID mission directors, either here in Washington or somewhere around the world. And so what is impeding progress, and where have we and they seen progress, and why? More or less across the board, they point to the fragmentation of foreign assistance, the inability, as a result of changing priorities driven by multiple actors, to implement a strategy that focuses resources with predictability on the real critical barriers to progress. And without predictability, they cannot form meaningful partnerships with their host government counterparts, with other donors, or with their partners on the ground. They cannot make sustained commitments to what will truly address the root causes of poverty in the country in which they are working. The unpredictability of their funding is due to a number of factors, but this afternoon I want to focus on two. First, unpredictability is due to failures in the executive branch to put systems in place that allow for a demand-driven, collaborative process for allocating funds to shared goals, let alone to the right shared goals. As many of you have heard me note on other occasions, our past strategy for foreign assistance was whatever got cobbled together from the myriad missions, offices, bureaus, and agencies involved in foreign assistance, each acting on their own sets of very well-intended priorities, but the strategy was whatever the sum of all these individual parts turned out to be. Second, sector-driven allocations have meant that the field received flavors of funding that did not always match the most compelling needs in that particular country. For example, one country needs basic education money, but the only money available is for family planning. Or another country needs money for agriculture, but it is only biodiversity funds that are left. And so year after year, those in the field patch together a foreign assistance program that indeed alleviates suffering, but it yields patches of green rather than flowing, interconnected pastures of green. There is no one group or organization or agency to point to for the lack of a coordinated system of foreign assistance. Rather, I would say we have created this situation together. Members of Congress are responding to constituent expressions of interest or to their own very heartfelt concerns when they earmark funds, and why shouldn't they? How else are they going to know how those funds are going to be used? And they are, after all, taxpayer funds. When we announce new initiatives, the executive branch is striving to address compelling unmet needs in the developing world, or to develop strong partnership ties with our international neighbors, or to promote critical foreign policy interests. NGOs are responding to what they truly believe are the needs on the ground when they lobby for funds for a particular sector. All sides are trying to work within the balance of power to reach an end result of doing what they believe to be right. If we could rest assured that we are doing our best, then there would be no need for reform of foreign assistance. But I believe that we can and we must do better. The stakes are too high for us not to commit ourselves collectively to doing all of this better. When domestic programs aren't working well, we can count on our own democratic system to vote leaders out of office and vote in those that the voters believe will do a better job. But our partners in developing countries do not have the privilege of voting those of us in the development community out of office for not doing our jobs better to meet their needs. And yet, our policies and lack of coordination surely impact the well-being and oftentimes the very lives of those very people. So on their behalf, I share with you today four principles that I believe can and should be principles that we can all rally around and come together to support. One, we must focus on country progress, and the new strategic framework for United States foreign assistance explicitly focuses on country progress. The goal is to help build and sustain democratic, well-governed states that respond to the needs of their people, reduce widespread poverty, and conduct themselves responsibly in the international system. Its explicit intent is to move countries from a relationship defined by dependence on traditional foreign assistance to a relationship defined by full sustaining partner status. In past budget years, much of the budget was built not by country, but by sector. So much for family planning, so much for basic education, so much for security assistance, and so on. And then funding from within these sector levels were parceled out country by country on the basis of multiple individual sector-based strategies, a strategy for family planning, a strategy for education, and so forth. You get the picture. But in many areas where we have chosen to give X dollars to a sector, we have based this decision really, in all candor, on what it means for us rather than on what it does for them. I don't mean that these sectors are not critical in a country's development strategy. Clearly they are. But it's a matter of what should drive the country's development program. Country prioritized need or a set global amount for a sector. We must tailor development programs to the unique needs of each recipient country in reaching the transformational diplomacy goal. This year, we made foreign assistance planning and budgeting country-focused. We brought together teams of experts from USAID and the State Department here in Washington, and with consultation with their field counterparts, and we gave them an overall target number for each country, not by account, not by sector, just a total. And we gave them the data on the status of each country's progress against independent indicators assessing poverty, human capacity, life expectancy, governance, barriers to economic growth, and so forth. We gave them the new strategic framework for U.S. foreign assistance and the balance of interventions it implies for the circumstances unique to each category of countries. And we then asked them to allocate that budget to the areas that would best advance each individual country's progress. Now, we did set three sector levels for HIV/AIDS, malaria, and food aid, because the emergency nature of each of these interventions demanded a different approach. And indeed, their allocation by country was not inconsistent with what each of the countries were requesting. The benefit in this year was in coordinated planning based on the totality of U.S. government resources being planned all across the board for each country. We were able to ensure, looking across agency contributions, that programs are mutually supportive and coordinated with maximum impact and maximum likelihood of sustainability. That's the first principle. Two, we must focus our resources where they will make the most sustainable impact. Foreign assistance in the past has run the risk of being a mile wide and an inch deep. With 1,000 agendas embedded in our foreign assistance programs, our impact was diluted and diffuse. And it's important to note, as I often do, that there is very little that we have been doing out there that is bad. Someone, some community, is benefiting from the services we are providing and the interventions that we are supporting, but that is not the point. The real question is, are we achieving sustainable impact? Are we doing more than short-term charity? Are we, in fact, enabling transformation? Are we giving people what they need to sustain further progress on their own? Based on the new country-driven process, we have prioritized resources to the areas that we believe will promote and sustain long-term country progress. Funding is increased to programs targeted to improving governance and democratic participation, programs mitigating diseases that threaten the human and economic capacity of countries to progress on their own, programs that expand access to and improve the quality of education, programs that enhance economic opportunity and the skills that are needed to participate in the global economy. All of this is the result of a demand-driven process that asked experts to prioritize limited resources on the basis of the most significant levers that will achieve country progress, and to focus our resources so that we can achieve real impact from that focus. I often think about our past practices of allocating funds as being similar to teaching a single individual a little French, a little German, and a little Spanish. If we keep doing it, then that person will very slowly be able to speak a little more French, a little more German, and a little more Spanish. But maybe if we instead took the resources spent on each language and put them all toward one language, if that was the critical language for moving that person where that person wanted to go, then that person would be able to communicate fluently and would then be able to learn the other languages on his or her own. Similarly, when we split up our resources into too many sectors in one country, progress will be slow and indeed often imperceptible. If we instead focus our resources, we enhance the ability of a country to gain enough strength and stability in one sector to sustain further progress on their own. Third, we must focus our resources in states that are critical to long-term stability and prosperity. In the fiscal year 2008 budget request, you will find that 51% of Department of State and USAID program assistance resources are concentrated in rebuilding and developing countries. These are the countries that are farthest away from sustaining partnership status as measured by instability, poverty, human capacity, life expectancy, governance, and barriers to economic growth, all critical barriers to regional stability and indeed to success in the global war on terror. We have seen the risks that ungoverned spaces can pose to our national security and to their regional neighbors. We are also very aware of the costs of these ungoverned spaces to these countries' own citizens. States like Somalia, Afghanistan, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo are among the poorest in the world. Their citizens are among the least able to access basic needs, including security. At the same time, to truly transform the development landscape, we also need to focus on developing states such as Nigeria, Ukraine, Pakistan, Jordan, and Indonesia, states that are on the cusp of transitioning to economic, political, and social self-sustenance, and that with continuing progress can serve as anchors for regional stability and prosperity. We need to work with them to help them strengthen their institutions to make their progress permanent. Fourth, we must do all within our power to achieve full funding for this year's foreign assistance request. The piece parts of this year's budget are intricately intertwined and based on principles designed to maximize country progress. But like a Rubik's Cube, where all of the colors are neatly arranged on each face when the problem is solved, when one side has to be moved and the other colors on all sides of the cube begin to get jumbled and misaligned, then we have problems. And so if we are to achieve this kind of alignment, if we are to truly achieve transformation, the first thing we need is every penny requested in the fiscal year 2008 budget for foreign assistance. As you all well know, right now we are in a climate of budget fiscal constraint. For too many, foreign assistance is a politically uncostly target for cutting the budget. Many of us have, in fact, been told by a variety of observers and participants to expect a lower budget level as it goes through the process. With this in mind, we might be tempted to fight for what has for too long been referred to as traditional development assistance, defined as the funds that help only the very poorest, the very base of U.S. foreign assistance. But I ask you to consider, what is traditional development assistance? And is that a term that we really want to use to describe what we are trying to achieve? Country progress that will help build and sustain democratic, well-governed states that will respond to the needs of their people because they have the capability and the capacity and the will to respond to the needs of their people, and to reduce widespread poverty because they have the focus, the motivation, and the capability to address widespread poverty, and in the course of doing that, to conduct themselves responsibly in the international system. Tradition implies ritual, custom, habit, convention. Is that how we want foreign assistance to be considered? I would argue that we need progressive development assistance. Every penny helps countries progress. Democracy programs that help build the institutions and the accountability for health service delivery are every bit as integral to sustainable development as the delivery of the service itself. The U.S. government cannot continue to provide funds for service delivery at the expense of the institutional capacity building that will enable that service delivery to be sustained. We need to rid ourselves of that tradition if we are to convince the American people and the Congress that they should support foreign assistance funding. If we are to have this budget request fully met, then each one of us here today, and all of your friends, and all of your friends' friends, will need to understand the importance of protecting the entire foreign assistance budget. If there is a leak in the foreign assistance budget boat, just because it is not in your end of the boat will not keep the boat from sinking. Congress needs to hear your voices in support of the whole, the entire solved Rubik's Cube, not one that becomes distorted and misaligned. Over the past 9 months, my office has put a lot of ideas on the table about how the U.S. government can and should move forward with transparency, with coordination, with accountability, and with greater effectiveness. We have worked closely with the Office of the United States Global AIDS Coordinator, with the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and with others to ensure that our country-based plans complement the inputs of each of those organizations. And we have developed a system that will better define and track what we are doing with our foreign assistance resources. We have taken the critical first step of getting our own house in order. But in all honesty, I would have to tell you we have only begun. At the same time, we need the help of each other to think about how we can build a foreign assistance process that unites donors, implementers, and host countries in putting together in each country one national development strategy, one mechanism for implementation of that strategy, and one system for monitoring and evaluating development programs in that country. We need the ideas of practitioners and of experts to continue to help us refine both what we are doing and how we are communicating what we are doing. I am grateful to those of you who communicated to me or to my staff that the transformational diplomacy goal in its initial form needed to explicitly include the word poverty. I hope that our decision to include poverty is an indication to you that we are listening. We want your ideas, and we want to work with you. Change may sometimes not occur as quickly as you would like. I know it doesn't occur as quickly as I would like, but it doesn't mean that your input is not or will not bring about change. At the same time, I am heartened by what I take as signs that we are truly together in this mission. Over the last couple of months, my staff and I have met on numerous occasions with many leaders in the development community and on the Hill. We have presented the framework and reform elements to multiple consortia of NGO groups, including Interaction, the Global Health Council, the Global Leadership Campaign, faith-based NGOs, environmental NGOs, education NGOs, labor NGOs, and gender equity NGOs. We have solicited input from these groups on the framework itself, on the indicators that we will use to measure our progress, as well as on our process for ensuring that our foreign assistance resources are integrated, coordinated, and comprehensively targeted to the achievement of the transformational diplomacy goal. Throughout this process, I have been struck by the fact that notwithstanding an incredibly fast-paced process, which has in many cases limited our ability to communicate even more thoroughly with all interested parties, the principles of this reform seem to have widespread support. As we move forward together, I do want to humbly ask that you do the same thing that I have asked our USAID and State Department employees to do, and that I asked them to do really when I started in this position, and that is leave your uniforms at the door. We will better engage with one another and achieve more gains in development when we think about our suggestions in terms of them and not us. The attraction of the idea to include poverty in the transformational diplomacy goal was, in part, that it didn't belong to one organization or one sector. It belonged to the united interests of our movement. Parochial interests that are not grounded in data or country progress do not serve our cause, and they do not serve our goal to have the President's foreign assistance budget request fully funded. Those wishing to find ways to cut the budget will be looking for ways to divide us. We cannot and we must not allow them to do that. We must not, because we are in this together. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We started to receive a few of your questions, and please feel free to keep passing them to the ushers and my colleagues in the aisles. They'll get up to me as quickly as possible, and I will try to put them together into clusters if possible. I think the first question is, in light of the kind of asymmetry of the assistance, that there are other forms of U.S. resources that are spent in countries, defense in particular is mentioned here, do you believe that there's a need for a cabinet-level development position?
Well, I think that over the long term, the organizational issues of how best to do this probably need to be thought through. My own personal view is no, but I don't necessarily think there are any right or wrong answers to that. What I do believe is that it is extremely important that our foreign policy objectives and the knowledge and expertise that our foreign policy community bring to the table and our foreign assistance activities be linked at the hip, so to speak. And that is really what we're trying to do. By the fact that on the one hand I am the USAID administrator and on the other hand I am the director of United States Foreign Assistance, and in both cases reporting to the Secretary of State, it has enabled us to put some processes in place that I think will bring more coherence to the process. At the time Secretary Rice and I first talked about how to address foreign assistance reform, we decided that with the two-plus years remaining in this administration, we were going to be better served to put our energy and our efforts at state and USAID, which accounted for, at the time, roughly 80% of U.S. foreign assistance. I think it's a little less than that, but something in that range. But it is absolutely true that there are more things across the government that we do need to bring together in a more coordinated way. I think there are a variety of ways to do that, but right now it's Monday, and I'm focused on getting through Monday and on to Tuesday.
There seem to be several questions about measuring progress and country progress and whether we're really capable of recognizing what good governance looks like. Perhaps you could describe some of your measures, and then whether longer-term goals may be put aside for shorter-term results?
There are another number of important points that I think relate to this general area of goals and metrics. Secretary Rice is, from time to time, talks about, usually using democracy as an example, talks about when she first arrived in her role and raised the question, how much money are we spending on democracy programs around the world? And nobody could answer that question or couldn't answer it very definitively. And I concluded that it was pretty obvious we couldn't do it because we didn't have the databases to gather the information. But I concluded there was another important reason. If someone asks, how many Chevrolets are there in the United States? That question is answerable because that kind of data is kept in Bureau of Motor Vehicle databases. But it's also answerable because there is a clear definition of what is a Chevrolet. When we say how much money are we spending on democracy, what are we talking about? Are we building political party capacity, or are we building a road that enables people to get to the places they need to vote? And so we have put a lot of effort into putting together a catalog, if you will, of definitions that will tie directly to the budget and then tie directly to the metrics we are using to measure the outputs. And so when we put a program together for a country, there's going to be clarity on the part of everybody involved on just exactly what the piece parts are and what we're trying to do. Now, with respect to the very important second part of that question, one of the groups that I would specifically thank for the work that's been done over the last few months are people who have had a specific interest in gender equity, because they have been very, very helpful to the people in my office in bringing to bear expertise on what are the experiences that people have already had on what works and what doesn't work in how you measure things. And so we are incorporating the benefit of that knowledge into the way in which we're measuring things. We are trying to do that all across the board. But we need to be able to harness all the expertise that we can as we go forward.
This question, if the U.S., quote, shouldn't fund service delivery at the expense of institution building, end quote, what is the rationale for such a massive increase in HIV/AIDS funding when a large percentage of that will go to delivering treatment and not institutional solutions to prevention? Why is this approach to HIV/AIDS sustainable?
Well, actually, it is sustainable for the very reasons that I laid out, because much of the effort in the early days of launching the AIDS initiative was in building capacity. I think there were a lot of people who were focused on getting people on antiretroviral drug treatment, meaning let's buy drugs at the least expensive price we can buy them. That's fine if you have doctors and nurses and lab technicians and distribution systems and inventory measurement systems and quality control and all the things that are necessary to put in place to get people on treatment. And you need all of that. And that's why in the early years, when the president committed $15 billion over 5 years, the answer wasn't 15 divided by 5 is 3. It was, in the first year, I think, $2.2 billion, much of which was really devoted to building capacity. And now that the capacity has been ramped up, there's a much more massive infusion of resources in order to deal with the delivery. But you have to do both if it's going to be sustainable. Otherwise, I fear that the day the money stops and we go home, there's not going to be anything left that people can take over and sustain on their own.
There's a practical question about how the country levels were determined. Could you describe that in particular?
There was some art and some science. I can tell you, for starters, how they were not determined. They were not determined by looking at the prior year's budget and saying, if this is what we did last year, then this is what we need to do going forward. We looked at a lot of indicators available from a variety of sources to try to understand for each country what its status was with respect to these measures of poverty and democracy and economic growth and child mortality and a whole variety of things, and came to some judgments about if the pie is going to be this big, then how much of this pie should go to this country and this country and this country. And then in the process we put in place, we made some further determinations, again based on these measurements, and looking across the five objectives in the foreign assistance strategic framework that I'm confident most of you are familiar with, at what the relative distribution of funds ought to be across those five objectives. But as we began to pull this together and the teams that were working on each country did their work, I then pulled them together as regions with some fairly senior people at USAID and state and in some instances other parts of the government. And I asked two fairly straightforward questions, and that is, in this region, if this ends up being all the money that we get, did we get it about right in the way we have distributed the money among countries, or should we take another look? And in some instances, people with on-the-ground expertise said, really, if this is what we end up with, then it's probably more important to move some money from this country to that country, and we did some of that. And then I asked the question of, within each country, if this is all the money that is available, did the teams that worked on this get it about right in terms of the distribution of the money across the five objectives? And in some cases, we made a number of adjustments there. So it was very much an iterative process that started out based on the best data that we could pull together.
There's a question about the ability to address regional issues and the regional dimensions as solely, as well as solely bilateral dimensions. For example, issues related to ungoverned spaces of which you spoke.
One thing we tried to do was to force into the process greater precision with respect to what is bilateral and what is regional and what is global. And for example, we have funded historically, both in the State Department and at USAID, in central programs that were always intended to be implemented in a particular country. And so in those instances, we've tried to drive that down in the planning process so that on a country-by-country basis, we could look at the totality of resources across a country. But by the same token, as the questioner says, there are some things that can be done more effectively on a regional basis and indeed some things on a global basis. And so we have tried to identify what those things are and put them in the budget accordingly. As we go forward, we need to be taking, and we are very actively doing this at USAID at the moment, we need to be taking a hard look at our tools and determining, are we doing this, whatever this happens to be, are we doing this on a bilateral basis or this on a regional basis because we're determined that's the best way to do it? Or are we doing it that way because that's the way we've always done it? And there are probably some things where the advent of information technology, for example, may provide us the opportunity to do some things a little differently than we've done in the past. But that's kind of a work in process.
If poverty reduction is such a vital interest of ours, have you found that reinforced by tying your job between USAID and state? Have you found a comparable commitment at state to the poverty reduction agenda?
Well, I can probably judge that more anecdotally than I, you know, can scientifically. And I can tell you that one morning a couple of weeks ago, in Secretary Rice's morning meeting with the assistant secretaries and above, when we were going around the table, I described the decision that the secretary and I had made to put poverty in the goal and why we had, and just looking around the room at the body language, there was an awful lot of this going on in the room, which I would interpret as both understanding and support for that. By the same token, I think it is important to find the right balance between keeping USAID as a separate independent agency, which both the Secretary and I are very committed to do, but on the other hand, a separate agency that has a more clearly defined relationship with how it works with the State Department, so that we are getting the best of both worlds, because the pressures tend to come from different directions depending on what people's jobs are. But I think we're sorting all of that out and making really a lot of very good progress.
There's a question about international harmonization, that if we were to create even U.S., the kind of U.S. harmonization that you're describing, how are we likely to make improvement in the international arena?
When I was working full-time in the HIV-AIDS world, my friend Peter Piot, who runs UNAIDS, I'm sure many of you know him and know about what I'm about to describe, but Peter came up with this idea that became known as the three ones, and I alluded to that in my prepared remarks. But Peter tried to sell, and I got very much on board with what he wanted to do, to get every country to do these three single things, to have an HIV-AIDS strategy that was a single strategy for the country and that was bought into by donors, by the government, by people living with AIDS, by civil society, but one strategy that everybody understood. Secondly, that there ought to be a single coordinating mechanism where all of the people who were participating, again, government, civil society, and others, were involved in that process. And third, there ought to be a single monitoring and evaluation system, because as the presidents of some of the African countries told me in 2003, the good news is that more and more donors are coming to help us address HIV-AIDS. The bad news is that more and more donors are coming to help us address HIV-AIDS, and they all want to measure everything differently, and they're chewing up all the available people working on their staffs to do all these duplicated kinds of things. I believe that if we could take that same kind of concept and stretch it across all foreign assistance, that would represent huge progress. And I'm trying to do everything I can to encourage that kind of coordination across the donor community. I view it as kind of like a neighborhood 4th of July picnic, where you have a menu, and maybe country A says, I want to bring the salad, but I don't care about these other things. And country B says, I want to bring the dessert, but that's the only thing I'm good at. And country C says, I'm too busy to bring anything. I'd like to write a check, and you do what you want to do. There ought to be a role in this so that, everybody can participate as they see their own political needs at home, maybe, or whatever the case may be. But it's done in a more coordinated way than I think the donor community is doing at the moment.
There's a question about coordination with the Defense Department. Your framework includes assistance portfolios under peace and security, which are controlled by state but administered by DOD. IMED has mentioned, how do we coordinate further on security cooperation? Do state and DOD share priorities and partners?
Well, DOD is very interested in finding ways to improve the way we're doing that, as am I and my colleagues at USAID and state. I spent a half an hour late last week with General Petraeus, for example, talking about some of the things that we need to be doing in as closely coordinated a way as we can when he gets to Iraq. I've had lots of meetings with lots of people in the Defense Department, as have people, again, both at USAID and state, working through how these processes work. There was a pre-existing process, principally between DOD and the Political Military Bureau at state, that really serves as the backbone for how some of this is coordinated. And the challenge is less changing that and more being sure that that process is plugged into the broader process so that our planning for peace and security expenditures is not a standalone stovepipe in one of the 155 countries where we're working, but rather it's an integrated part of all the other things that we're doing in that country. And that's very much at the heart of what we're trying to do.
There's a question about conditionality, whether it's increasingly going to be a thing of the past, in particular related to our dealings with countries like China, where we've taken a very non-invasive approach to their political and economic development.
Well, you know, there's conditionality and there's conditionality, and it depends, I guess, on what specific usage people are making of that word. One thing I would like to see more of, and I doubt that this is exactly what the questioner means, but I'd like to see more of our tying some of our money to budget support tied to the achievement of specific benchmarks, so that as countries are making reforms and making changes within their government or the policies of their government, that we can then see our way clear to funding the things that will help them build and sustain that.
There seem to be several questions that are asking whether there's not something inherently contradictory about the diplomatic approach, which is to our own benefit, the development approach, which is to the benefit of the country, and maybe the humanitarian goals, which are for a broader ambition. How do you square those?
Well, as some of you at least know, I've spent most of my life in the corporate world where there are natural tensions. I was on the board of directors of a chain of newspapers where there was always a tension between the people on the business side and the people in the newsroom. When I was at AT&T, there was always a natural tension between the people at Bell Laboratories who were inventing something and the people in marketing who, if they just understood what we were inventing and could sell it, you know, everything would be fine. And I think the world is kind of filled with all of those kinds of natural tensions, and I think they're just fine. But really what we're trying to get done here is, at the end of the day, create a more peaceful, more stable world, the results of which will clearly be in the best interests of the people of the United States. And getting there, I think, is very much in response to what we, most of us, feel as Americans in terms of our desire to respond with our humanitarian instincts to helping people who need help. But I think there's a real convergence of what, in the end, we're all trying to get done, and that is to create this more peaceful, stable world by helping or encouraging or insisting, as the case may be, host governments to do the things that are necessary or give them the capability to do the things that are necessary so that they can increasingly respond to themselves, to people in their countries that are suffering from poverty. And that's on the path of getting us to this point of a more stable world. I have the huge privilege of occupying the office in the old part of the State Department that was the office of General George Marshall from 1947 to 1949, when the Marshall Plan was created. And I keep, as some of you have been there know, I keep listening for voices because I need all the advice I can get. But General Marshall said in his famous 1947 Harvard commencement speech, when he laid out the principles of the Marshall Plan, you know, he made very clear that this is not about the United States developing a plan to rebuild post-World War II Europe. This is about the nations of Europe coming together to develop a plan to rebuild Europe, and then the United States determining how can we best plug in to that plan, perhaps in helping to shape the plan, but in the end, how can we best plug in to help? And that's really at the heart of what we're trying to do here.
Several questions about the transparency of the money, whether we've been able to account for it has spent up to now in terms of the value to the taxpayers, but also in terms of your ability to actually find the various pipelines and sort those out in your current process?
I think a very diligent job has been done over the years in accounting for the money. And in fact, I think we are dealing with a lot of bureaucracy that I sometimes wonder, do we really need to make it this complicated? Or are there simpler ways in which we can do what needs to be done and still have the assurance that we know where the money is going? But what we have not been able to do, and that's what we're very much doing now, is to have, for example, a database in place so that you or I or members of the Congress or people overseas in the countries where we're working can go into that database and look at all of our money and see with whom are we partnering, what is it we have agreed that will be done with that money, what is it we have agreed that will be achieved as a result of doing what we've agreed to do with that money, and what are the results? Did that happen, or did that not happen? And we want everybody to be able to see that in a very transparent way, and we're putting the mechanisms in place to cause that to happen.
A number of questions also about the Congress and how the election results this past fall will affect your plan. Whether you see Congress, one question suggests that this is essentially reducing their role, their traditional role, by maybe giving up the earmark model. Or do you see an actual decreasing in the amounts of earmarks as a result of this process?
You know, I'm less focused, even though it may not seem that way, I'm less focused on eliminating earmarks than I am focused on eliminating the need for earmarks, and then members of Congress are going to have to make their own judgments on whether they want an earmark or not. But I will tell you that if I was a member of Congress and I was really concerned about some particular issue or some particular country, and going into this process, I wanted to be certain that I knew that what I was concerned about was going to happen, what are the tools available to me other than an earmark? I mean, there's no strategy I can look at. There's no transparent measurement system I can look at. And so I think that's one of the reasons that all of this has developed. And I think from my conversation with members of the House and Senate and key staff people on the Hill, I think people are going to look in a very open-minded way at what it is we're trying to do. And then they'll have to make judgments. But what people will be able to see much more clearly than we've been able to demonstrate in the past is, yeah, we can move money from here to here, but if we do, here are what the implications are going to be relative to what the data tells us are the things that really need to be done if it's our objective to move this country on a trajectory. I've had a very cordial reception on the part of people on the Hill on both sides of the aisle. When Mr. Colby, for example, was chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee, I had a very good relationship with him, and he understood the issues tremendously. Mrs. Lowy, had a good relationship with her then, have a good relationship with her now. I think people who are involved are very, very interested in trying to get done what we're trying to get done. You know, there are going to be differences of opinion on emphasis, and that's part of the benefit of trying to make this as transparent as we can, is that people are at least going to understand how did we get to wherever we got, and then people can reach their own conclusions.
There's a question about the Department of Defense and Congress supporting its move into areas of governance and development assistance through combatant commander funds and other DOD authorities. What are your plans for ensuring a holistic foreign assistance strategy using all instruments of national power?
Well, again, I think it's a work in progress to figure out the specifics of how best do we do that. But I think one thing that both people in the Department of Defense and people at USAID and the State Department and the National Security Council and others who have an interest in this, I think the view that we all share is that in a number of aspects of this, it is very clear that the military and the civilian parts of the government need to have mechanisms to work very closely together in certain aspects of what we're doing. And it can't just be passing it over the wall. You know, we have to be together in the way that that things are planned and carried out. And as I alluded to earlier, we have a number of activities focused on trying to figure out how to do that better.
Do you look at any other countries as models for how they're handling their foreign assistance?
Yes, I do, and we're trying. I suppose the follow-on to that is name three, and we're trying to go to school wherever we can. I'm visited with frequency by people in other countries who are essentially wrestling with the same kinds of problems that we are. The Japanese, for example, with whom we have a lot in common, are currently involved in a fairly thorough relook at what we are doing. And I'm sure there is much we can learn from a number of our donor partners across the world.
Question about the private sector. Is it willing to assist with these goals? And is such assistance in their interest? Why or why not?
I'm finding a growing interest on the part of the private sector, driven by a combination of things. For example, when I was, again, running the AIDS Initiative, we did some co-investing with a company in South Africa that was in a business, the nature of which was that they had built a clinic to take care of their employees and employees' families in a community, but there were other people in that community whose needs were not getting met, and by co-investing, we provided some money to expand the clinic based on the investment that they'd already made, and enabled us to expand the healthcare in that community on a much more cost-effective way than if we had had to start from scratch. You know, that's an example. We have a wonderful story to tell about a USAID program in Rwanda that addressed the needs of about 40,000 farmers to teach them how to grow high quality coffee and to set up cooperatives and marketing programs to enable Rwandans to compete in world coffee markets. And if you go to Starbucks, you will find on the shelf at most Starbucks a premium-priced, premium-quality Rwandan coffee. And that came from a USAID program, and USAID has folded its tent and pulled out because the people now have the skills to sustain that on their own. I mean, this is just all sort of a stream of consciousness, but last week or the week before, whenever it was, when I was at Davos, I met with the chairman and CEO of Coca-Cola, with whom we have a USAID Coca-Cola water program where we're, they're very pleased with it and we're very, very pleased with it. So there are a number of areas where we're working together, but I think we can leverage the private sector and the resources that are available in the private sector and the expertise that's available in the private sector in certain areas much more fulsomely than we historically have.
For fiscal year 08, you request a large increase in ESF and a large decrease in development assistance. Could you please explain why?
Well, for those of you who have seen this, I don't know how many of you have seen this yet, but the summary and highlights, I put a little chart in here. That when you get this, it's on page 9, that looks at the programs in 06 that were funded with the DA money and the programs that were funded with ESF money and then the total, programs in democracy, in investing in people and in economic growth, and then looks at the same thing, the combination of development assistance in ESF in 08. And what you see when you look at the total is that the total goes up from 06 to 08, but we have shifted from from, in some cases, from DA to ESF. Now, the reason for that is principally one of reading the act that created these accounts and trying to move in the direction so that the accounts are being used in the way that they were originally intended to use. I think there are probably some who think, gee, there must be a plot here somewhere, and really is to just try to straighten up the accounts so that the accounts are being used in the way that the that they were intended.
I would say there are probably 15 questions about various forms of aid, and asking you to evaluate or to suggest their value, everything from alternative development to microcredit, a variety, virtually every kind of programming that exists right now. Is there any way that you can take on some of those questions, since we really probably, this is probably the, one of the last three questions?
Okay. I'm not sure. I mean, I could pick out one or two. Microcredit, for example. I was in Lebanon a few weeks ago, and I visited a young man, probably in his late 20s, who was the son of a dairy farmer and had inherited 10 milk cows. And through a USAID microfinance program, he'd been given the money to buy two more. And so with the revenue from the 12, he paid back the loan, bought two more. And with the revenue from that herd now, he bought two more. And at any rate, on the day I was there, he had 17 milk cows, and he had two modern milking machines, all of which were made available by the microcredit that came about from this program that has USAID funding, because he couldn't have gotten any other kind of financing. He's part of a cooperative that we are also have also created in Lebanon with an NGO partner, where I could walk you through the details, but the bottom line is that this group of 100 or so dairy farmers are now manufacturing and selling cheese packaged in a way and meeting the quality standards that it's being distributed in the region, not just in Lebanon, but throughout the region, and they're selling it very competitively. These are people that two or three years ago were producing milk, you know, on their little farms and selling the products along the side of the road or in the village market or whatever the case may be. And there are hundreds of examples of these kinds of things. But rather than my focusing on, you know, this is good and this is better, I would say that one of the things that I want to do with a lot more vigor than I think we have done in the past is to figure out, in part using our measurement systems and in part using other evaluative tools, what are the best practices, and are we sharing that information in ways that are both timely and useful to people who can take advantage of that? I don't want to stifle experimentation, but I also don't want us to reinvent the wheel when we don't have to. So there are too many cases where it's somebody's opinion about, you know, I like this and I don't like that. And I think it's possible to have a little more fact-based approach to this than we have had. And the accountability system that we're putting in place is really intended to do just that.
There are a number of questions about countries, and I think that about the genocide in Darfur, about whether the assistance to Lebanon that Secretary Rice pledged at the Paris Donors Conference is likely to be met. I think perhaps rather, I mean, you certainly address those if you could, but perhaps you could also take on the two largest aid recipient countries right now, Iraq and Afghanistan, and what you think needs to be happening there in order to reach a more successful result or achieve the progress that we're that you're describing.
Let me say, with respect to the first part of that, that this has been a very, very complicated process for all of us who've been involved in putting this budget together, because we've been putting together an 08 budget, an 07 supplemental, a separate part of the 08 budget that's really focused on the global war on terror and on those things that really shouldn't be on the base because they're not the kinds of things that are going to continue over the long term. And in the meantime, the overhang of what is 07 and, you know, the uncertainty about the continuing resolution and all of that that's just kind of been resolving itself in recent days. And so all of that is in here, and it will be in the bigger volume that will be coming in the next couple of weeks. This is all now available on our website, both through the State Department and through USAID. And over in the course of time, and there's country-specific information in here on the website by account. But as we go forward, there will be country-specific information in here that will tell you what I'm really more interested in, and that is what are we trying to do across the range of activities in countries. So I would really refer you to that with respect to the specific questions that people have about the details of the budget. Iraq and Afghanistan are very different in some ways and very similar in some ways, and the similarity stems from the fact that we have an incredible number of very, very brave people, both inside the government and locals, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, who are working for us and with us, and people I suspect from some of the organizations that some of you represent, who are working on all these issues. And in concert with improving the security situation, we are trying to, at the same time, work aggressively to improve both the economic situation by improving the economy and improving jobs, creating jobs, helping to create jobs, and doing so in ways that are sustainable, while at the same time we're working on the fundamental mechanisms of the deregulation of telecommunications or the establishment of regulatory schemes where there aren't any, or the basic mechanisms that people need in order to be able to start a business and start a business easily and sustainably, the aspects of rule of law that are necessary to make that happen, and the fundamental skills and capabilities both within the government and outside the government to make all of these things work. We've got an enormous amount of effort underway on this, and I'm very hopeful with the progress we're seeing.
I think, first off, why don't we make this the last question?
Okay.
And thank you all for your questions. I'm sorry that I've had to interpret them kind of on the fly here. I always like to hear your voices, but I think this is one way to get many, many questions out. And thank you for submitting them. This one is really about sort of the management of this plan. And it wonders, and several people came at it in different ways, whether there's really the agility and the flexibility balanced with the constancy. So how will these plans be constantly changing, or will there in fact be, will people be able to stick with them? And there also seems to be a recurring theme of central micromanagement, of a fear that while there has been consultation, that at the end of the day there will be a green eye shade approach to these issues that seems to trouble some people.
Let me, since this is the last question, let me first of all apologize for my obsession with the water here. My doctor put me on a decongestant that causes my mouth to get dry about every 4 seconds. Besides that, my Indianapolis Colts caused me to yell a little last night.
There was one congratulations from the audience as well that I did not share. Sorry. Sensitivity to the Bears fans.
Causing me to totally lose focus on what you're
we're micromanaging the issue of micromanagement and how you get a plan that actually is as wise as you have suggested.
If this all works in the way that I have in mind, there's going to be, if we measured on less versus more, there's going to be less micromanagement than exists today. But people are going to be managing different things. I think to some degree we're doing things in the field today that ought to be done in Washington, and we're doing things in Washington that ought to be done in the field. And so the real intent of all of this is to not have a situation where a USAID mission director comes up for rotation and everybody gets their intelligence on who the next one is going to be, and then says, oh, we're going to shift from healthcare programs to education programs because that's where the orientation is. That's no way to drive a strategy. So the strategy ought to be driven on some of the things I've laid out about what do we need to do in a country to get the country from here up to here. And then Secretary Rice and I are saying to the U.S. ambassador and the USAID mission director, okay, here's the left side of the road, here's the right side of the road, here's where we want to go. You might prefer, you might be, have it more fun if we did this or that, but here's where we want to go. Now, you tell me what's the best way to get there. And the country operating plan process will involve the countries producing a plan that looks at the budget we're giving them and looks at these overarching objectives and says, okay, we want to partner with this organization and we want to spend this amount of money and here's what we're going to do to achieve it. Those will come in to be reviewed mostly to ensure that they, in fact, conform with what we've agreed we're going to try to get done there. And then the countries will be told, get on with it. And so I think the money will be implemented more quickly, and I really think the field is going to have much more to say about it. But, of course, there's apprehension at the moment because people haven't quite seen this work. But that's the way in which we certainly intend to go.
Please join me in thanking Ambassador Tobias.
Thank you very much.
We've got a few down there. Okay.